Hello. On this week's program, a conversation with Leif Ove Andsnes. He performs the Brahms Second Piano Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra. He's also just released a CD of Brahms and Schumann piano quintets with the Artemis Quartet. Jason Pfeiffer takes us inside the Suzanne Roberts Theatre, the new home of the Philadelphia Theatre Company, and has a preview of the venue's inaugural show, Being Alive. And Susan Lewis profiles one of the country's largest and most glorious pieces of public art, Philadelphia City Hall. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Over the past year, the Norwegian pianist Leif Ove Andsnes has been a major part of commemorations of the centenary of the death of Norway's most famous composer, Edvard Grieg. He filmed throughout Europe for a TV special, which culminated with a spectacular performance in Norway's Hardanger Mountains. He also recorded Grieg's Ballade in G minor and performed the work at the composer's home. Andsnes has also been exploring the works of Johannes Brahms. He recorded Brahms' piano quintet in E-flat major with the Artemis Quartet and will perform the Brahms' second piano concerto in concerts with the Philadelphia Orchestra this week. I met with Leif Ove Andsnes earlier this week. In the last year or so, there have been two composers who have been preeminent in your life, shall we say, Grieg and Brahms. Edvard Grieg, I suppose, is preeminent in every Norwegian's life, all of their lives. But this past year, you've been commemorating the 100th anniversary of his death.
Yes, and I wouldn't say that Grieg is prominent for me all the time, because I take longer periods when I don't play him, actually. But I always come back to him. There is something very wonderful about his music, something very intimate, which brings you in. I think it's mainly the harmonies. You hear after two bars that this has to be Grieg. Such a beautiful way of handling the harmonies and the melodies. They have such a narrative quality to them. And I just love his music. And my sort of discovery for this year, even if I knew the piece but I hadn't played it, was the Ballade for Piano, Opus 24, which is a major solo piece. It's his biggest piece for solo piano, actually.
And he went as far as taking a grand piano up a mountain and playing it there.
Yeah, well, that was part of a TV program which I did for Norwegian TV, where we sort of followed the footsteps of Grieg and went different places where he went. And he was very fond of the mountains, and that was one of the reasons why we took a mountain up piano up the mountain, and I played there, and then also, of course, for the camera, it was rather a spectacular scene.
Non-Norwegian, I think you can almost hear the fjords in some of his music. Somebody once told me that the very DNA of what it is to be Norwegian flows in the music of Grieg. Is that the case, do you think, or is it just something you take for granted, being Norwegian and having an understanding of it?
It's an interesting subject, because I think we do feel that Grieg is very Norwegian, and there is certainly a force of nature in his music, and he did use a lot of folk music elements in his music, which means that it sounds Nordic and it sounds Norwegian. On the other hand, I think we have, because Grieg got such an identity we have taken his sounds as our sounds, if you see what I mean.
I understand. Yeah.
So we take Greek's harmonies as Norwegian harmonies, but actually maybe they are more Greek than Norwegian.
Playing a very large part in your life at the moment is Brahms.
Mm-hmm.
You have a CD of his piano quintets, and you're here in Philadelphia to perform with the Philadelphia Orchestra, Brahms.
That's true.
A work that's new to you now.
The second concerto, yes. It's a piece which I've had such a respect for and I've loved my whole life. But I just took my time, and I thought a couple of years ago, okay, will I never play this piece? And now is the time, And I went for it, and I took this summer off. I studied it this year, and it's been such a fantastic journey. It's unbelievable music. I'm so happy to now play it. So I'm playing it a lot this season.
Do you have to be at a certain stage in life to get Brahms? I was talking to somebody recently, and they said that it wasn't until they were in their 30s that they considered Brahms anything more than head music.
I don't know. I've
Have you always got Brahms?
Not all of Brahms. Actually, there are pieces that have always seemed incredibly emotional to me, like the piano quintet, which I've recorded now, with the Artemis quartet. That was always a piece that I loved so much, and but I didn't study it until 3 years ago, and I felt finally I get to study this treasure of music. That's the great privilege of being a pianist, because you have such a large repertoire, you can actually wait with some pieces. With the second concerto, I think it was different because I felt it had a lot of challenges, both pianistically and musically, that I didn't feel ready for earlier. And I just took my time and thought, okay, I will set aside a period of studying it later in life, and here I am. Now I've done it. But one part of Brahms which I had a problem with earlier was the sort of rather academic side of his music, right? Like some of the variation pieces and the Handel variations and these sort of pieces. And now I sort of love that too. I think that there's some hidden great emotion under that.
But when you approach something like this Brahms Second Piano Concerto, do you approach it also academically, or is everything you need to know there on the page in the music?
I never think that I approach things academically, actually. But then it's a question of what is academically.
Do you learn anything in the context of when it was composed or something about the musician?
Well, I might do that, but then it's that's a sort of... that's a sort of hobby on the side, then. I don't think that's necessary with most pieces.
And it doesn't play into your final interpretation?
Not normally. I mean, there are some cases where I found it very useful to get to know things about the composer. Actually, like the Greek ballad, which I just mentioned, there is a very strong story behind why the piece is so dark and melancholy, and his parents had just died, and he had problems with his marriage, and many things, you know, which sort of played a role. And after I got to know about all these things, I thought I could have a deeper understanding of the music, but that's normally not how it works. I think you can really discover a piece of music through the score.
Because you are, or have been many times, praised for the purity of your interpretation, that you're not trying to impose yourself on it.
Well, that's a...
It's a compliment.
Interesting, yeah, it's a difficult question, but because... well, thank you. But it's also an interesting thing, because I never feel that I put distance between me and the music. But maybe on the other hand, I don't like when things are overstated, and I think understatement can be sometimes richer in music than overstating things. But it's a fine balance always.
Leif Ove Andsnes. He's the soloist in this week's performances of the Brahms Second Piano Concerto with the Philadelphia Orchestra, conducted by Osmo Vanska. The final concert in this series, which also features works by Sibelius, is this evening at 8 o'clock at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
For over 30 years, the Philadelphia Theater Company has been a prominent player in the city's theater scene. With a loyal audience base, the company is one of the oldest theaters in the region. Yet over the decades, it has never occupied its own theater space, until now. Tomorrow afternoon, the Philadelphia Theater Company will host a ribbon-cutting ceremony, marquee lighting, and open house for its new home, the Suzanne Roberts Theater on South Broad Street. Now WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer takes a look at the latest venue on Philadelphia's Avenue of the Arts and the first production it will stage.
It became clear some time ago that the Philadelphia Theater Company had outgrown its former home, the charming but rather small Plays and Players Theater in Center City. After nearly 4 years of planning, fundraising, and construction, the Philadelphia Company is more than ready to settle into its new place at Broad and Lombard Streets and invite visitors. Producing Artistic Director Sarah Goranzik says tomorrow's ceremony will officially launch the new building.
We're going to cut the ribbon, we're going to light the marquee, and we're going to fling open the doors to every square inch of this space, and we're going to allow the public to come in and take a tour and see what we've been after these last 3.5 years.
Upon entering the lobby of the Suzanne Roberts Theater, which is named after the wife of a key donor, Comcast co-founder Ralph Roberts, visitors find an open space dominated by glass and steel, in full view of the street activity outside. Designers wanted the lobby to feel like a part of the city, and it does. But once inside the auditorium, one finds an entirely different world. Two levels of yellow upholstered seating for 365 people are wrapped by walls lined with deeply curved light brown panels. It creates a very stylized, contemporary feel. This is different from many theaters that construct or perhaps convert buildings into black box spaces, nondescript auditoriums with black walls where the seating and stage can be moved around from show to show. From a technical standpoint, the flexibility of a black box to accommodate complex design elements is unparalleled, but the decor, individuality, and grandeur that so many older auditoriums have, like the Academy of Music, is lacking. Richard Maiman, one of the architects of the new theater, says the primary goal from the beginning was to create a space that had the best of technical capabilities.
But we wanted to have a theater that celebrated theater as an event. It's not simply a machine for having a performance here. It's a place of event, and particularly an evening event, such that there's hearkening back to theater tradition, a rich space that was very inviting and enveloping to the audience.
One of the more striking features of the theater is the leather-tiled proscenium opening that frames the stage, hiding many of the backstage mechanisms, such as lights, that are commonly in plain view in other theaters. Sarah Goranzik says the more formal and traditional design choice is largely to the credit of their old home, the historic Plays and Players Theater, which also has a proscenium.
We love producing on the stage of Plays and Players because it had really perfect proportions that we tried to recreate here just on a larger scale. So when it was time to start over, the big question was, do we want to forget all about that completely and just start anew? Because we really could have designed any space we wanted to. Or do we want to continue on with that configuration? And there was never any question in our mind that we found it continually inspiring. So Plays and Players helped us fall in love with the proscenium, and we're sticking to it.
Another thing that the Philadelphia Theater Company is sticking to is their mission to produce new American plays. The first show slated for the new venue was to have been Terrence McNally's new play, Unusual Acts of Devotion. McNally wrote the play with actor Kathy Bates specifically in mind for the lead role, but Sarah Goranzik says Bates was forced to withdraw from the show for health reasons.
This thing was written so much in Kathy Bates' voice that we thought, it's not right. Why reconceive this whole idea? Why don't we push it off to another time, you know, when she's available, when she's feeling better, and find something that, you know, is unfreighted with that.
What they found was a musical called Being Alive, a piece that Goranzik had been following in development for over a year and had originally wanted to include in this season anyway. It's a celebration of Stephen Sondheim music, using Shakespeare's Seven Ages of Man from As You Like It for dramatic structure. This is the famous soliloquy that catalogs the different stages of a man's life, with the opening line, "All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players." Billy Porter conceived and directs Being Alive.
I think it's very profound that our show starts with "All the world's a stage," and we have the opportunity to be the first people to say that on a brand new stage and to christen it.
Porter says the impetus for creating this show was his love for Stephen Sondheim music as an African-American performer.
African-American performers in Sondheim aren't usually synonymous. And so I was just interested to kind of see what I could do in changing that.
Not satisfied with a straight-up musical review, Porter wove in the Shakespeare component of the show to provide a through line for the collection of songs, which includes Send in the Clowns, Children Will Listen, and Being Alive. Porter has worked directly with Stephen Sondheim at different stages in the development process of the show, ensuring that the composer's intentions for the music are realized. Yet Porter notes his renditions of the songs undoubtedly have a new flair.
Shakespeare, you know, has been interpreted in many different ways. I think that is exactly what we're trying to do with Sondheim. And so we have brought it into many of the different African-American musical idioms, from gospel to jazz to hip-hop to R&B to rap to soul. It's all of it.
In keeping with the Philadelphia Theater Company's niche, Being Alive is a show that features distinctly American work, show tunes from Sondheim. And though not entirely new, the material is reimagined in a fresh way. Likewise, the Suzanne Roberts Theater takes cues from the rich tradition of American theater houses, while presenting a brand new venue for Philadelphia audiences to experience. So as the theater's marquee officially lights up tomorrow for the first time, another era of the Philadelphia Theater Company blending the old and new begins.
Somebody hold me too close. Somebody hurt me too deep. Somebody sit in my chair and ruin my sleep and make me aware of being alive, being alive.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. Following tomorrow's ribbon cutting and lighting of the marquee, previews of the Philadelphia Theater Company's inaugural show in their new home begin Wednesday. Being Alive runs through December 2nd.
And put me through hell and give me support for being alive. Make me alive. Make me alive. Make me confused. Mock me with praise. Let me be. Care. Somebody make me come through. I'll always be there.
Philadelphia City Hall sits alone on Center Square, the city block in the middle of the geometric street plan set out by Thomas Home, William Penn's surveyor general in the 17th century. The building was finished in 1901 after 30 years of construction and is still the largest municipal building in the country. This week, for the third time since it was hoisted to the top of the building in 1894, the statue of William Penn was cleaned. WRTI's Susan Lewis took the opportunity to visit Penn and his civic home.
Anyone taking the tiny elevator up City Hall Tower to the observation deck is in for some fantastic views of the city for miles in all directions. But on the sunny October day we visit, there's more going on, even a bit higher. The statue of city founder William Penn is getting a bath. His first in 1987, the second 10 years later, and this, his third cleaning, have all been performed by the same team of people from Moreland Studios of Stockton, New Jersey, including David Kahn.
We take care of and maintain bronze monuments for municipal governments and private collectors.
Are they usually this high?
No. We did work on the Statue of Liberty, but even that's not as high as this is.
How high is this? Well, City Hall is about 548 feet from the street to the top of the tower. The statue itself is 37 feet tall, but really, at this point, who's counting? At the crown of his hat, it's a bit breezy.
And we can pop the top off so you can see how he's built in sections. There's 47 sections of castings that are flange bolted together on the inside so then they could put them up here. They couldn't put them up here in one piece.
Up here, we can see details lost to us from the ground. Wavy hair, coat buttons, lace on his cuffs and scarf, the letters of writing on the scroll he holds in his left hand. Next to his leg is the stump of a tree. Nice composition, but also convenient for gaining access if necessary when no scaffolding is up. Mr. Penn has a hollow leg, and body, as it turns out. Someone suggests we climb into the top of his head, which seems like an excellent idea, if only to get out of the wind.
Well, from down there, you can see his face from the inside, what his face looks like from the negative. And also the amount of graffiti that's in here from all the different people from different projects coming up here. Here's an original signature here from 1899. I think that was the head of the foundry.
This statue was one of over 250 sculptures created by Alexander Milne Calder. Below Penn on the tower are four other bronze figures, two Swedish settlers and two Native Americans, each about 24 feet tall and 22,000 pounds. The rest of the building has carved sculptures over arches, under portals, and along each side. All you have to do is look up. Greta Greenberger, City Hall's director of tours, says the building celebrates the city's history, accomplishments, and its multicultural, multifaceted people.
There's really almost every profession, every trade people were involved with is represented. I mean, you have teachers, musicians, miners, farmers. Over just about every arch entrance, there's a keystone in it with different themes. War, and there's peace, and there's all these different examples of transportation. So it's endless.
The impressive number of sculptures matched the ambitious nature of the building. Constructed with 88 million bricks covered in stone, in the French Empire style, it is the largest masonry-supported structure in the world, with walls 22 feet wide in places. Greenberger likens its shape to a square donut. Every office has a window opening to either the courtyard or the street. All three branches of government are here. The mayor and his administration, city council chambers and offices, and the courts. City Hall also houses public records and handles issues of marriage licenses, deeds, probations of wills, and voter registration. Greenberger says the interior is rich in decorative arts, including mosaics, wood carvings, and decorative metal.
And in some cases, they're just painted a color. Other places, they've been gilded. But even other places, they've been faux finished to look like wood grain to match wood paneling on the walls.
Despite, or maybe because of its grandeur, City Hall has not been universally beloved. Randy Cotton, Associate Director of the Preservation Alliance for Greater Philadelphia, says it was high style when construction started in 1871.
The ironic thing is it's such a massive building and built to such high quality, it took a very long time to complete, I think almost 30 years. So when it was completed, spectacular building, there were some people said it's already out of date.
Its size may be its blessing as well as its curse.
I think the reason that City Hall has survived in so much of its original condition is this too large and too massive and built of too much quality materials that it would just be too expensive for someone to demolish it.
Survival is one thing, maintenance is another. The Preservation Alliance is paying for the cleaning of William Penn with a fund started in 1987 when the city was restoring the tower. A group of citizens raised nearly $1 million for the restoration of the statue. $470,000 were left over, which they gave to the Preservation Alliance.
Along with the responsibility to inspect and maintain the statue into the future.
In 1987, Moreland Studios came in to clean what was then an extremely dirty statue. Constance Bassett, president of Moreland, says it looked like many of the turn-of-the-century bronze monuments that had not been maintained.
It looked green with islands of black material spotted throughout, some of which was very aesthetically disfiguring.
Moreland ran tests to figure out how to effectively clean the statue without dispersing unwanted elements into the air, says Dave Kahn.
You couldn't use any of the traditional methods to clean them. You couldn't use any kind of abrasive cleaning because any of the abrasives would have gone airborne and would have been all over the city. And with the wind load up here, you couldn't encapsulate the statue because the wind load would be too great.
The answer? Good old soap and water. In 1987, using ultra-high-pressure water cleaning, that's 27,000 pounds at the nozzle, they stripped the statue down to the bare metal, colored it with a brown patina, and put on a protective coating of wax. Subsequent cleanings have involved working with soap and water, toothbrushes and blowtorches, and cotton diapers to blot out as much of the old wax as they can. They've also used laser to clean some of the corrosion spots. No one would say it's easy to clean a statue 500 feet in the air. Constance Bassett says problems range from access and weather to potential concerns about exposing workers to radio waves from increasing number of antenna on neighboring skyscrapers. And yet,
it's really quite exciting to surmount the difficulties. Perseverance is what I think we're most proud of.
William Penn himself never had this view, but he did have a vision of new possibilities of civic life. So it is fitting that his likeness stands on top of a building created through perseverance and celebration, one that combines ordinary functions with extraordinary artwork and silently shouts out to all who take a moment to look up and listen.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. And that's it for now. Our thanks this week to Lana Emmett, Lauren Saul, and Charles Gagne. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.